Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 77 of Registry Matters. Larry, another fine Saturday night for us to be recording a podcast because we have no other lives that we need to tend to.
It is fantastic. It's a beautiful day and I could be out in the land of enchantment, 71 degrees, 9% humidity.
What is enchanting about your state?
The climate and the people, the diversity and the tolerance. There's just so much enchanting about the state. You couldn't believe how wonderful it is to be here.
Well, considering that you're there, I can't imagine it's all that enchanting.
Well, I mean, it does have its downsides. But,
One out of what's the population, like 3 million, 2 million?
About 2.1 million.
All right, so one out of 2 million. There you go. So one out of a million. Good job. Well, let's get things going. We got a new patron. We are welcoming Rebecca. I am so very excited. She's a good friend of mine, and thank you so much. And also then thank you to all of our patrons. It really shows that you appreciate the work that we're doing here and helps keep us motivated to keep recording on every Saturday night.
And she's listening live in our fantastic chat room.
In our broadcast studio that traverses the whole interwebs. We got a question from a patron user. I think it came actually over in the Patreon feed, and says, "I'm wondering if anything can be done about Facebook, the company banning sex offenders with the ruling handed down in North Carolina. I mean, if Verizon blocked registrants or Gmail did it, there would be an outcry by the ACLU and the courts would correctly step in. I know it's a private company, but the service they provide has been ruled by courts to be akin to public squares, telephones, and the like. Can we do anything, Larry?"
Yes.
What can we do?
Well, there's a lot of questions blended in here about the Facebook. The court did opine that the state could not prevent people, and it's important to draw that distinction because that was the only issue being examined. There was North Carolina statute that said anyone that had to register could not be on Facebook or other social media platforms. And therefore, we don't know how far the court's thinking would go. But then he brings in the ACLU, which is the organization that everybody loves to hate, but yet it's the organization that gets the most criticism for not doing everything that it should do to save sex offenders. But yet I've met one sex offender in my life that's a member of ACLU. It's the most puzzling thing I've ever seen. So I'm going off on a tangent here. They get so much criticism about what they should do when they're a membership organization. They are a union. If you notice that union is in their name. So they're a union of people who've come together to pool their resources to fight things that are of a priority to the members of that union. And the members of that union have not prioritized fighting for sex offenders because that's not what they've signed up to do to donate their dollars for. I do believe if more people who are required to register would be a member of ACLU and respond to their surveys about what they would like to see the union working on, I think that could change. But even if there were thousands of people that are members, then you've got the PR component that the ACLU has to look at. And although they have been willing to undertake unpopular causes, taking on a giant like Facebook, which would dwarf and mammoth everything that the ACLU could put together in terms of resources, many times over, taking on that, and it would also be in the court of public opinion. Facebook only put that policy in because of the public opinion outcry that they should ban these horrible predators from luring and seeking out new victims. Facebook was drag kicking and screaming into this by public opinion. So the ACLU would be fighting massive public opinion, gargantuan resources, to try to lay new case law saying that a private company doesn't have the right to determine who can use its resources. Now he's right. If you're to be banned from having an email account, there'd probably be more of an outcry. But an email account in of itself is not the same thing as networking, where you can become friends and connected with someone on email. If you have a Gmail account, that doesn't directly connect you with a minor, does it? I mean, you could use it to communicate with a minor, but that doesn't directly connect you. Facebook, you can go, and I don't even have a Facebook account, but you can go and look at profiles of people of all ages, and you can submit friends requests to them. You can read whatever information they may make public and their postings, and you could theoretically do a lot of trolling that you can't do by accessing a Gmail account.
From a technical point of view, if you wanted to say that this class of people couldn't have access to that class of people, the other class being minors, it seems like it would be a flip of a switch to say it. And it also then feels like people, at least the people still under supervision, most likely have a clause that say they cannot be in contact with minors. So you've already got them either breaking a probation condition, if not some kind of law. But yeah, how do you deal with the people on the backside that have finished their sentences? I don't know that Facebook has a leg to stand on beyond that they're a public company.
I mean, they don't have a leg to stand on.
Well, I mean, they have, from the point of view of just saying, hey, these people can't have access to Facebook because, they can't contact minors, so we're not going to let them on Facebook at all. These people have triggered the oogie factor. The creepy factor, we don't want them here, not in my backyard. It just, like, I don't, beyond that, there are plenty of other people on there that are certainly non-desirables. The guy from Christchurch that did the shooting in the mosque, he, you know, televised it, and it got hit millions and millions of times. That is not a person that you would want. That would be the public's perception, is that you don't want those people on Facebook. The anti-vaxxers are huge on Facebook. You have UFO conspiracy theorists and all these other people that are running around Facebook doing demonstrably bad things and harming people with the fake news, with conspiracy theories and all those things. Having someone just present there doesn't necessarily do that. So I don't see, like, it's a flawed argument that they would say these people who have not always committed a crime that was against a child, we're just going to ban them outright from being on Facebook, even though their crime might not involve a child.
I agree. And this will be a good time to talk about the feedback we've received over the past week about us sounding like we're defending. I'm not defending Facebook. I wish they didn't have the prohibition. What we're talking about when we talk about things here on the podcast, we're talking about whether there's a legal remedy or not. And if so, what is the viability and what are the odds of it succeeding? And what would it cost to fund such a legal? I think there are some challenges. I've said on earlier podcasts, I think there are some challenges that could be made. It's going to be expensive. Facebook, since they're worried about public opinion, they are going to fight back. They're not going to say, oh, okay, the sex offenders want to be on our network. We realize we've made a mistake. Come one, come all. They're not going to do that. They would only do that if public opinion had shifted and the public was rejecting this discriminatory practice of Facebook. The public is not rejecting it. The public is rejoicing, and the public is what caused them to initiate the ban to start with. So I'm not supporting it. I'm not defending it. I'm merely pointing out that it's going to be tough. And the case law in Packingham does not address this. It addresses state interference.
Right.
There could be a brand new case come forward that says that we want to challenge private interference. And I would welcome such a case. I would like to know how we're going to fund it, because we're talking about six figures many times over to get such a challenge to the U.S. Supreme Court. Assuming that they would grant review after we worked it through the lower courts and got to the possibility of getting to the Supreme Court. Will the ACLU undertake that challenge? I can't speak for the ACLU because I'm not on their board and I'm not on their staff. But I can speak from a pragmatic business point of view that they're trying to keep their dollars flowing from their members to do the things that their members have identified and their donors have prioritized. And this is not one of them. And they would not be willing, from a business point of view, to alienate their donors, to start having people pull their checkbooks back and say, well, I'm not giving to this organization anymore, because I'll be damned if I'm going to defend sex offenders, if I have my money going to fight for sex offenders.
Yeah.
So they have to make a business decision. So I'm merely explaining a business decision that they might make and that they do make on a regular basis when they're looking at cases that they're going to take. They look at how their donors are going to support that, and
the winnability of that action, if they think that they have a reasonable shot at winning, so they can recover all the thousands of hours of time that they've gotten invested into it. In a case that they don't see as winnable, if they don't see it as reasonably winnable, and they see it as going to alienate their donors from a business perspective, that's not a real good case to undertake. You know, I don't make the rules for life. I'm just simply telling you what they are. And that's not a good business model. If you piss off your donors and you take a case you can't win, so you get to devour all your resources fighting a losing battle. I'm
completely with you. And the solution that I see is that this would never happen, but a government takeover of Facebook, not going to happen. Or the government build a post office-esque social network that everybody is allowed to be on, and then you have the government doing it, and then they can't ban it because that would be a First Amendment breach. Can we double back just real quick? Why doesn't Packingham prevent an entity like Facebook from blocking us?
Because it was the First Amendment is designed to protect the citizen from governmental intervention and suppression and infringement. It does not, you have no right to a private owner's. Try going to your church on Sunday and say, Reverend, I want to take the pulpit for today because I've got a message that kind of is different than yours. Try going down to your local radio talk show and say, I'd like to commandeer your microphones for the day. You don't have the right to speak on a private platform. You have the right to be free from suppression from the government as you speak. The government is not suppressing you from being on Facebook. Facebook is. Now, the government put a lot of pressure on Facebook without any statutory requirement. They encourage this. And they make it easier through the collection of the monikers. When you give them your email address and all your screen names at your registry office, there's a big giant data dump that goes into a governmental database that all the registry officials can dump these into. And all the social media outlets are given access to this data dump. And that's one of the ways you get dropped is because you've provided this by statute to the registry. The registry has dumped it into the resource that social media uses to screen out and clean up their list. So you may be on a private registry where the few that are left that are not, where you're not listed publicly, and you may still get kicked off Facebook because they may catch you through the data dump. And I forget what that platform's called, but there's a place where all these monikers and screen names and whatnot are listed for social media to take advantage of.
What about the comment in that question about it being akin to the town square? Where would that? Would there ever be a breach where the government could then say, no, let these people on?
Well, I certainly can't speak for everything the courts might do.
Sure, of course.
I don't see the same exact analogy because it's not the government doing it. I mean, you guys can change the Constitution and say that freedom of speech cannot be interfered with by private entities and try getting that through the process. But good luck with that, because you got to get it through 2/3 of both houses of Congress, and the 3/4 of the states have to ratify that. But right now, that's not what you're protected from. You're protected from governmental suppression. And I didn't write the Constitution. I'm just telling you what it is best to understand it.
Right, right. The problem that I personally run into is because of the age that we are, and it keeps advancing at such an extreme pace. Elizabeth Warren and so forth, and all these people, they may turn around and go, hey, I'm going to do a Facebook town hall. Well, crap, I can't attend it. But so that is a breach of my First Amendment that they're using a platform that I am unable to receive that message.
Government's not doing it.
But the politicians, like the government, is then using the platform to then distribute the message, and there is a barrier in there. I understand what you're saying. It just like there feels like there's encroachment, some gray area where the two are overlapping at some point.
Well, we're going to have the evolution. Now, some who don't believe in the evolving standards of society, who believe in strict interpretation, I mean, you would never be able to get there from here. But the government is not stopping you. It is Facebook that's stopping you.
Right.
The government just simply encouraged them to be more selective about who they allow on their network.
Yeah. I'm with you.
So I would love to see the litigation. I don't see the ACLU as being the lead on that litigation because it's not a constitutional protection. if it were a governmental intrusion, the government is not telling you you can't be on Facebook. It's just like international travel. You can travel all you want to as long as the country will let you in.
Right.
The government's just simply telegraphing the information in advance before you get there, so they turn you back.
Right. Here we go again, man. What organization do you think would do you think there's somebody that would initiate that kind of challenge? What kind of organization would take it up?
I think it's going to come down to the offenders themselves. I think the offenders themselves, rather than claiming that they're all living under bridges and tents and holding tin cups, are going to have to be a lot more generous with funding causes of action. And in defense of NARSL's donors, they're very generous, just don't have very many of them.
Yeah, sure.
The 800,000, you know, the number on our roster is so small.
Right. Yeah, no, I totally know that.
And they would have you believe that they're all living in tent cities. And too damn many of them are living in tent cities. Absolutely. There's significant underemployment and unemployment. But of the 800,000, there's not 800,000 unemployed and underemployed. There are a lot of offenders who are doing quite well financially. And so this will probably run off some listeners, but I think that those who are doing quite well should be a little bit more generous with supporting it. Because I think rather than waiting for an organization to save, I think it's time that we start saving ourselves.
Right. Well, you know, on that note, you talk about driving listeners off. We tried that for a while and it didn't work. It went backwards. Just letting you know, if you're actually trying to run them off, it went backwards.
Also, we're growing.
We are growing. I got bad news for you, man. We have good numbers from last week, but that's probably all because of Guy. That'll go back to normal. Well, let's start hitting these articles. I bet you this one's more up my alley than yours. The push to predict police shootings, tracking officer stress, exposure, and body camera practices could help keep them from pulling the trigger. This comes from The Atlantic. This is having machine learning and computer algorithms determine the state of mind of a law enforcement officer. And I guess maybe like, hey, you're on desk duty today because, hey, your wife kicked you in the shin on your way out the door and your kid got some bad grades. You shouldn't be out because you might potentially pull the trigger on someone. And my favorite thing in the article, Larry, if I can find it easily enough, it's like the officers do not want to have some sort of controlling authority that says whether they're up or down. They don't want to have some sort of technology determining where they are. But at the same time, they're using all this technology to predict where the crime's going to be. I find that to be a little hypocritical, if you ask me.
No.
I know, right? Oh, there it is. It says police officers are the first ones to say, hey, that's unfair. I'm not going to get this promotion because some algorithm said I might be more violent or at risk than someone else. And you want to turn around and say, exactly, it's unfair that some kid gets put on a heat list because he lives in a poor area and he's surrounded by poverty and violence. That was my favorite clip in the article.
Well, I guess it's just demonstrative of the hypocrisy in humans.
Anything else you want to cover on that article before we drive along?
I didn't. You're right. I didn't find it where I could be much of a contributor to it. But it reminds me of parents and kids. Anybody who's listening, who's raised an adolescent, your kids will tell you when they want to be different. They'll tell you, Mom, Dad, why do I have to conform? Why do you tell me I have to do something because it's the way I have to? Why can't I be? Why can't I have bolts and screws in my face and in my tongue and my nose? And why can't I do all this? Why can't I be unique and have my hair spiked up a foot and a half in the air and painted green and purple? Why can't I have my own individuality? Okay. But then magically, that same adolescent, they quickly turn and do a flip flop when there's something that they would like to do that all the other kids are doing. That's the crowd herd mentality.
Right.
Then they'll say, well, everybody else is getting to do that. Everybody else gets that. And you try to do that as a parent, try to say, well, you know, you just got through telling me that you can have spiky purple hair and you can have screws and bolts out of your skin and you should be an individual. How come I can't be an individual as a parent and not do something just because all other parents are doing it? And they completely do an about face on you and say, well, and I can't explain it, but they say, well, everybody's doing it. So those of you that raised a teenager, raised a child through adolescence, tell me how you square that up, because they want you to conform in every way as a parent, but yet they want to be complete rebels themselves and say that I want to be my own individual.
Absolutely. I do see, I mean, our society is on a massive collision course with all this artificial intelligence, machine learning, learning algorithms, and so forth. And we're on a collision course, and there's going to be a lot of negative outcomes along with a lot of positive outcomes. But jeepers, there was an article, I don't think we put it in here, is that law enforcement is feeding pictures of celebrities into their analysis database looking for people that may have committed a crime along the way. And if you train these things on the wrong data, on a biased set of data, you're going to have biased results. It's not a good thing. Well, let's move on over to an article from The Appeal. Simon Liu, L-I-U, so that could be Liu or Liu, isn't a sex offender, but he's still on the registry for life. Larry, we've talked about this sort of thing before. How does someone get not convicted of a sex crime and they end up on the registry? I'm deeply puzzled on how these things occur. Like 9 months ago, we talked about someone from Georgia that ended up being acquitted, I think, or expunged, something like that, but he still had to register. So here's another guy that didn't get convicted of a sex crime, but he's on the registry.
Well, there was a sex crime committed. He just wasn't the actual committer of it.
That's right. I remember that now. That's right. He was present, so they tagged him along with the guy that did it.
Well, by golly, if you're going to be present when crime is committed and you're 13, 14, 15 years old, you're old enough to know what they're liable to do when they go in there. And he ought to have known that they were going to commit a sex offense. And by golly, he should be old enough to man up and take that punishment and have to register. Why are we wasting time on the podcast talking about this?
This article comes from The Appeal. There are some really interesting points that get made in here about how absolutely over the top ineffective the registry is. They say there's 108,000 people in the registry in California, which is 106, which is a gigantic number of people. And I don't really know how you monitor 106,000 people if something like 3%, 5%, 10% are the ones that quote unquote are dangerous. It seems like you have a lot of resources wasted when you're trying to watch everybody when you don't need to watch everybody.
Well, this exposes a flaw in one of the many flaws in the telephone crime. This came through back in the 90s when we were in the super predator scare about teenagers, and he was present in an unflattering situation where this crime was committed. But he apparently, from all accounts, everybody concedes he did not commit the crime, but he's registered and there's no process in California. The judge has said that she feels bad about it. There's nothing she could do about it at the time. And the only reprieve he has is through executive clemency, through Governor Newsom. And that's sad, because even under this tiered registry that's going to take effect in 2021, he's a tier three, and he would not be eligible to get any relief under the upcoming law that's going to be fully operational, I think, by 2021. But he's not eligible. So isn't this sad that he has no way off the registry?
And I'm not sure if it was the judge that sentenced him, but a Superior Court judge that is now retired, she said, "I think it violates the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution. I think it's cruel and unusual punishment as it applies to juveniles. If you label a juvenile with lifetime registration, I think it's unfair. I think it is wrong, and I think the law should be changed." I know that, like, I have an evolving understanding of what this podcast actually is. And that is one of the things. It's like you have said that courts are not, judges aren't roving tribunals, I guess it is. And here it is. If we want this to go away, then the legislature is the path. How do we get the legislature to pass things? We have to go build relationships and testify and do all of those things at the legislative level, because we're going to bitch when the judges do things that we don't want.
Well, it might be possible. I'm not going to proclaim to be an expert on this case because this is the first I saw in this article, but it might be possible that crimes committed when a person's a juvenile, even though he was tried in adult court, as I understand it, he may be able to challenge on some constitutional claim there, but that's going to be very expensive. And the sad thing about it is that this shouldn't have to be. It's like the case of the kid that went into Michigan, Zach Anderson,
okay,
that went into Michigan on the online. He met a girl online that was underage and then went into Michigan that made national news. And father spoke at the NARSL conference, at one of the NARSL conferences in Atlanta. And the bigger issue is you know, Zach should not have been in that predicament. But the reason why Zach was in that predicament is because we have strict liability offense schemes, meaning that the age, knowing that the person's underage, was no defense. Specifically in Michigan, the fact that she was only 16 and represented herself to be 18 was not a defense for the crime. We should change these things legislatively. The courts are not there to figure out what the best public policy should be. And I'm not defending bad public policy, but I'm telling you that the courts are supposed to be highly restrained, highly deferential to the enactments of the people. And if the people make bad public policy, unless it violates the constitutional, the courts are supposed to take a hands-off approach. That's what we encourage when we select people for the court. We ask them, are you going to be legislating from the bench?
Right.
We don't want you on the court if you're going to legislate from the bench. We want you to interpret that law, by golly. And you're supposed to defer to the will of the people unless it's defective from a constitutional point of view, not because you can imagine a better way to do something. It probably would be better if California wasn't wasting their money tracking 106,000 people from a policy perspective. Even if the registry were effective, it would probably be more effective if you were tracking a smaller number of people,
right,
so you could actually track those people. Now, I'm not advocating tracking anybody after they've done their time. So listen carefully to what I'm saying. But I'm saying, if you're going to have a registry, and if you're determined to have it, it's not the judge's place to determine what the size of the registry should be and what all should be included in the register and what the duration is. Those are policy choices. You made those, California. You did that, and you need to change that. Don't look to the robes to come up with a better policy. That's not their role.
I find in this particular individual, I'll give you a second to cool down so like your head stops exploding. But so this particular guy, while he was gone, he earned his GED. He excelled at college courses and learned computer programming. He has, I forgot where it said it, but he's got a pretty good profession. There's a picture in here where him with his arm around his sister. Good looking. They're not kids anymore, but good looking folks. And yet he's talking about how much this saddles him with such baggage that he cannot move on and have any sort of productive career. We often talk about, like, are we going to judge people in the totality of their lives or the worst day of their lives? And this just doesn't look like it's a positive impact on the future of someone after this goes on. Yeah, he made a mistake when he was 17 or something like that, and it looks like he's tried to come up, but he's got this freaking ball and chain that he's trying to carry around, and it's shitty.
But he was 16 at the time, and a recent Chinese immigrant who spoke little English, according to the story.
Yeah.
And I'm all for him getting off the registry. But I take the attitude that I took with Martha Stewart and Rush Limbaugh, so I'm going to be fair with attacking both. It would be nice if he would recognize that this registry not only interferes with his life and his ability to raise his family, that it'd be really nice if Rush and Jack, what's his name here, Simon, I mean, not Jack, but Simon, and if Martha would recognize that the system is so oppressive that it destroys a lot of people's lives. Maybe Simon should be off the registry, but so should the other 106,000 people, particularly if they've paid their debt in full to society. So Simon, don't just focus on yourself. You come first.
Right.
But we need to end the damn registry, because no one deserves this shame and humiliation, not just you.
Right. And that would be like a huge other angle, is it's always about me. I get it's about you, but can we try and figure out how to help the most people, more people than just you? But I mean, I, you know, unless you go to court with a class action, which I really don't want to go into that conversation, it is about you.
It is about him. Yeah, absolutely.
But
when he says this keeps me from living my life, and I wish he would say, and no telling what it does to the other 106,000 people.
Right.
As well.
There you go. There you go. Well, and then another article from the appeal. Louisiana bill could jail defense attorneys for doing their jobs. That's bad news. So the bill forces attorneys to choose between violating our ethical mandates or going to jail for following them. I'm going to, I guess, make my own interpretation. Does this a defense attorney that, like, the person says, I'm innocent until proven guilty, and the defense attorney should actually step up and go, no, this guy's actually guilty. I step down as being this person's attorney?
It's not exactly. This is regarding the rules on pretrial interviews. The defense attorney under this proposed rule is going to have to tell the person that they do not have to give the interview. Part of defending someone is to figure out what the accusers are going to say. Well, the best way to figure out what there's, I mean, you can just look at the police report, or you can go talk to them and see what they're going to say, and you determine if they're going to be credible, if they're going to come across well. And that's how you tell your client, this person is solid. They're going to come across very well. They're going to be very convincing. Or you go back and tell your client, this person was fidgeting. They were on dope the entire time. They can't put together construct two sentences coherently, and they're not going to be very credible. And they told a different story, but what was in the police report. So therefore, we're going to be able to impeach one of their previous statements. You can't do that unless you go talk to them. It's basically intended to chill. This is the victim's advocates, the people we're supposed to work hand in hand with someday. This is the victim's advocates saying that they don't want these ugly defense attorneys having these conversations with victims and witnesses. So by golly, they need to tell them up front, you ain't got to talk to me, but if you do, I mean, to me, this is nothing but intimidation. And I wouldn't be, I'm not surprised it's this coming out of Louisiana. The legislature there, you know, the one who believes the government restraint. It's interesting when you look at these conservative legislatures, they spend day and night trying to undo court opinions. Just ask King Alexander next time we have him on an event. Every time they win something through the courts in Louisiana, the prosecution apparatus runs to the legislature and says, "Can you help us overturn this with a new law? You know, can we get away with this?" But this is nothing but something trying to chill the defense attorneys from being aggressive and interviewing witnesses and trying to gather as much information as they can. That's all this is about.
Doesn't that absolutely break the system then?
It has the potential to. I mean, if you look at the chief public, or I don't know if he's chief, but Colin Rongo from the Orleans Parish said that said this is not necessary. Then there was a professor of legal ethics and criminal justice at Loyola University called the legislation an anti-defense bill and said that if lawmakers cared about victims, they would protect them against abuses by law enforcement and district attorneys as well. So, but this is sad, but this is where we can't have anybody, if someone is deemed to have possibly committed a crime, we've got to abolish the statute of limitations. We've got to abolish the confrontation clause. We've got to make sure that the defense attorneys can't do their job because we've got to get a conviction. That's the attitude of the victims' advocates of the law enforcement apparatus.
And that completely changes where the fulcrum is as far as the balance of powers. The prosecution has pretty much all of the money to begin with. Defense side has limited resources. If it's a public defender, it's incredibly limited, and we're going to hamper their ability to mount a defense further. And we're trying to do criminal justice reform and reduce prison populations. Isn't this going to actually like make it skyrocket?
Certainly would have a chilling effect if you were, because one of the comments was we'd have to take two attorneys to make sure that we didn't run afoul of this, that clearly we apprised them they had the right not to talk. Well, hopefully the victims' advocates apparatus, which is already significant in the system, they've told them, hey, when the defense team shows up and contacts you, hang up the phone, screen them out, block them. Don't have anything. I mean, they've already got people giving them their advice. I don't know why we on our side have to tell them and advise them. We don't represent them.
Would this, if that law gets passed, do you think that would survive some sort of court challenge?
It's hard to say, because there's the courts in Louisiana are more politicized because of the election process. So if it were litigated in state courts, I would say it would probably survive.
We definitely have a Supreme Court heavy show tonight. Here's the first article that comes from the New York Times, and it's about Kavanaugh and Gorsuch, justice with much in common, but they take different paths. I definitely need you to take the reins on this one and try and explain this legal theory stuff. So go ahead with that, please.
I didn't want to spend a lot of time on it. I just wanted to illustrate one point, that when we spend all of our energy trying to vilify a person, which I would have been happy if Merrick Garland had been confirmed, but he wasn't. But we spent all this effort trying to vilify this appointee, and lo and behold, he might turn out to be a little bit different than what the fears were. It's too early to tell. We'll know more when the big cases come out that are going to be coming out in the next 30 days. By the end of June, we'll have all the decisions on this term from this term. But already they're seeing that Kavanaugh is more to the center of the court, which the center of the court is
John Roberts,
Chief Justice Roberts. And the center is much more conservative than the center used to be back 20 years ago. But they're seeing that he appears to be more of a centrist. And it may be that he turns out not to be what everyone feared. Now, again, don't send 1,000 emails saying I'm in favor of him. I made it clear I was actually for the process of confirming the nomination of Merrick Garland. But I also opposed the character assassination they did with 40-year-old allegations that were never raised at the time. But we just might see a different Kavanaugh than what people feared. Just like when we got Justice John Paul Stevens from President Ford in 1975. He was taken over from the liberal William O. Douglas. And there were all this fear that civil rights would come to an end and that we would go back to the 1950s. Well, John Paul Stevens turned out to be nothing of the sort. So I would just say, let's just wait and see. We can talk about after the June 30th, end of the term, we can see where he sides on these big cases. And we can have a more rational conversation about where Kavanaugh really is. But it could be that the fears were overblown.
Hmm. I know that personally, I mean, I haven't followed much from Kavanaugh. Plus, he's only been there for a handful of months anyway. But it has felt like Gorsuch has been a bit of a wild card, maybe more of a libertarian mindset-ish, not exactly so hard right-leaning. I don't know if that's just me not understanding what's going on, but that's just how I felt so far.
Oh, well, I think I could agree with you on some of the stuff. He also seems to side with corporate interest on everything that I've looked at.
Yeah.
So the companies can do no wrong.
Yeah. Yeah, you got a guy that freezes to death while he left the trailer. It was like the first case that he sat on when he got appointed, and I don't remember the details, but a guy left his truck in the freezing cold, and so that he didn't die, and the companies I don't know. Anyway, he sided with the corporation.
You can't abandon a vehicle of that extent.
I mean, as opposed to dying.
Well, but that's the company policy. You know what the policy was. Now, I'm a literalist. I'm not supposed to make good policy for the company. I'm supposed to look at the policy. It was clear. And he understood it, and he signed and agreed to it. By golly, he abandoned the truck, and he had no business doing that.
Well, let's go to...
So you guys, you're always trying to make the courts undertake a role that they're not supposed to do. If you want different policy... Don't bring that problem to us. Take that to your legislature.
just go die. Sit in your truck and die. I'm sorry. I can't see how that actually takes precedent, or it doesn't take precedent over the cargo of the truck. But that's just my personal opinion.
He was in a tough situation. He could disobey company policy and pay the consequences, or he could protect his life.
Yeah. I know which one I'm going to take, and sorry. All right.
Well,
anyway.
He did that.
I know.
He paid the price.
I know.
So, well, then if you don't like that, change the law that says a company can't fire someone in that circuit. Don't bring that whining dispute to us in the court. We're not here for that.
But even the military, they will kick that back and say, you know, you're required to follow direct orders of your superiors, unless there are things called unlawful orders that would, like, you know, hey, I need you to punch yourself in the face for an hour. No, I'm sorry. You can't ask me to do that.
Oh, well, I don't know the specifics of that case well enough. I know I just heard the media coverage about it, but he shouldn't have abandoned the truck. The company has an asset there they have to protect, and it's not protected when you leave it.
Hey, this next article comes from a website with the subheading of Community for Cops. So this is like a social media site just for the law enforcement knuckleheads. So this is policemag.com. Oregon Supreme Court rules police can't take suspects' garbage without a warrant. Larry, I mean, so you throw some stuff in your can and you set the can at the corner. The police cannot tell the garbage collection company, hey, pick that one up and set it aside and we'll pick it up around the corner. That is an unwarranted search and seizure. And I think I'm in favor of that plan, that they can't do that.
Well, I might have known you was going to come down on.
I know. I'm a lefty.
So, well, I mean, the doctrine's been around for a long time, but once you abandon it, that you no longer have an expectation of privacy. But I did not get the chance to read this decision. I'm probably going to read it before we do the next week's show, because it was fascinating to figure out how they got there, because the case law has been so well established that when you abandon ownership interest in something, how can you turn around and claim a privacy right?
Just in reading the article, the way that it says it is, it's not like abandoning it in a public trash can. It is abandoning it in your, like, quote unquote, your own trash cans. But then, yeah, it seems like once the garbage collection people would have then taken custody of it, then that it would be fair game. But doesn't that then expand out and mean like the whole trash dump is not any place that the police could go search for things without a warrant?
Well, I mean, having not read it, I'm guessing where they came down was that the person, once there's a, you become an agent of the state at some point. So what I would guess that they decided was that by going to the garbage company and saying, can you get this trash for us from this particular address, that person's become an agent of the state. And at which time you become an agent of the state, you have to operate within the rules of a state actor. So I'm guessing, without reading it, that that's probably how this came about. But all the doctrine on garbage had been that once you abandon something, you no longer care about the privacy. When you put it in the trash can and the trucks are coming, you don't know what they're going to do with it. For all you know, they take it and they take all the paper and they stack them up in nice stacks and read through them. You don't know what they do with them, but you've abandoned any ownership. You assume they're taking it and compacting it in the landfill, but you don't know what they're doing with that trash, do you? Have you ever followed your trash to know where it goes and what happens to it?
I do know where it goes, but no, I've never followed it.
So I'm guessing that the cops are asking the garbage company to become actors and agents of the state, and therefore they have to operate on the same rules of a state actor is what my hunch tells me.
A funny little side story: when I first moved into this area, and a garbage truck came by, and it had the little arm, and it came out and picked up the can and smashed it in, like, you know, like tipped it over its top and like shook it, and I was amazed. I took video of that.
We've had those here for about 25 or 30 years. You're just not getting those in Georgia?
It was probably close to 20 years ago that this happened, but I had just always experienced the guys driving around and two guys in the back of it, and then maybe they had some sort of lift that they could pick it up, but they would just pretty much just throw trash in the back. I was just shocked when that thing like picked it up and automated, slammed it into the receptacle back there.
Fantastic, that system, but... But yeah, this is a significant decision, particularly because of the longstanding doctrine of abandonment. And then this state Supreme Court say, nope, not so fast here. Be interesting to see if this spreads across the country to other state Supreme Courts, if people will cite to this and say, well, they said in Oregon that you have to get a warrant because these are agents of the state. And again, I'm guessing that. So if it turned out that that's not what they said, don't get too mad. That's how I see you could get there.
Right.
Would be to come up with that as a theory.
An article from the New Jersey Law Journal, powered by law.com. Bill easing time limits on sex offense civil suits signed by Murphy, which I guess it's the governor. I this one goes over my head again, but I think it's extending out statute of limitations, which is perfectly in our favor, I think.
Of course it is. Why would you object to having an unlimited amount of time to I get on my ranch. You're going to have my blood pressure so high today.
I keep hearing cases or situations where someone with the same name they're in the wrong place at the wrong time, and they get locked up, and they have literally no way to defend themselves. And I'm shocked that we would actually pursue having someone put behind bars for any length of time beyond what it takes to for them to defend themselves. And here we are, we're actually pushing that out to 10, 20, 30, whatever those number of years are. And even if you are absolutely innocent, but somehow you look the same, you touch the same glass or something that was in the area, you have no way to defend yourself.
Well, just be clear that this is on the civil side.
Sure.
But I get your point. and this is a victims driven thing, and it has as most things do, there's a monetary component to it. They really don't care as much about the person. I mean, if the person happens to have resources financially, then of course they would. When you in a civil action, if you can expand the statute of limitations, remember the burden of proof is not beyond a reasonable doubt; it's by preponderance of the evidence,
which is 50+1, right?
Right, and you have a lower standard of proof. You have no right to paid counsel. So say, for example, the person worked from for an entity that had deep pockets, and they sue the accused abuser that never got charged criminally. They sue them. That's a side issue. They don't give a damn about them per se. They care more about the Archdiocese of Santa Fe or the University of Ohio or the deep pocketed entity. This is a mechanism to get at the money, because these people need to be made whole. I mean, so therefore, this extending the statute of limitations for a civil action, you may not ever hurt the person who did, like we got Father Peralta here, I think, in New Mexico, that just got extradited from, and he's got the criminal convictions to deal with, but he's also got all sorts of civil actions. He ain't got a dime to his name. They don't care about him. They care about the Archdiocese of Santa Fe, where he was an actor and committing these unspeakable actions that he apparently did, or at least he's been convicted of them, whether he did them or not. And that's what this is about. It's the money, Andy.
Hmm. As if there's not enough money. I mean, are the attorney lobbies the ones going around trying to extend these out so they can keep dipping their finger in the kettle?
Oh, yes. And if you look at the margins of this, there's no opposition to this. Just to be clear, this is not a Democrat versus Republican.
Yeah.
It was approved by the full Senate 32-1.
Yep.
And in the House, the Assembly, 71-0.
And then what's that, 5 abstain or 5 just said present?
That's what I'm guessing. Five didn't vote. But there's no opposition to speak of to this. Now, I know that the state of Jersey is heavily favored Democratic, but it's not 100% Democratic. So you got a lot of Republicans voting for this as well.
Right. 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 Well, this next one comes from one of my favorite news persons, Nita Totenberg. She covers the Supreme Court for NPR. Supreme Court's conservatives defend their handling of death penalty cases. Obviously, this has pretty much nothing to do with our cause, but we covered this a month and 6 and 8 weeks ago, where there were two death sentences or executions that were happening, and one of them claimed he wanted to have his Muslim religious leader there with him, and Texas refused that one, and then another guy, I forget, was it like Missouri or something like that, and he was a Buddhist, maybe it was Alabama, and they said go ahead and let the guy there. And I was like, man, that is a really hypocritical decision there for them to say one guy can and one guy can't. Apparently with all the outcry from all of the from the public, that kind of forced the Supreme Court justices to actually put out some sort of memo justifying their reasoning behind their decisions, which I think is kind of interesting.
Well, yeah, and they did try to explain away at it, the nuances of the timing of the appeal from Alabama, and that some of the conservative justices are saying that that this is last minute tricks by the attorneys to delay the execution. And then there was one where the state had already thrown in the towel. They wasn't going to execute the person. And they said, no, it's okay. Go ahead and execute him. Did you see that?
Yes, 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 yes. I know. And then Texas turns around and they go, yeah, sorry, we're not going to have this controversy at all. We'll just ban all religious leaders from being in the execution chamber. I think they can be in the waiting room. But, you know, there's only probably like, I don't know, a half dozen or maybe 10 seats in those execution waiting or visiting rooms, whatever, vision rooms. I don't know. I literally feel that this is, they didn't like that the Muslim wanted to have his religious leader there, and that was bad, so they let the Buddhist do it. I literally feel that that's what the answer is there.
I'm one of those who believes that things were not quite that conspiratorial. I believe that the timing was also a factor. I would hate to, I mean, the judges are not immune from prejudices, but I would hate to think that was the deciding factor. Without evidence, I'd be reluctant to say that. I'd say that it's more likely than not that the timing of the request had a lot to do with it, more than that, but could be.
Yeah. It feels awfully, what's the word? Coincidental, I guess, is the word I'm looking for. Moving on to an article from CNN. This is maybe 2 or 3 months ago that Harvey Weinstein, that there was a Harvard law professor, a dean, that had just stepped up and said that he would help represent Harvey Weinstein in that whole big shit show that's going down. But the Harvard law professor representing Harvey Weinstein is being removed as a faculty dean because of public pressure from the students at the institution. So now him and his wife have... they're not going to be deans. And I guess it doesn't mean they're being fired, I don't think, but I don't think that they're going to really have their contract renewed, or at least they're not going to be deans because of all the public outcry. So here we go again. This is similar to Judge Persky.
Frightening, because of all places you would expect Harvard to be able to say, well, whatever their policy is regarding outside representation, that's what they should be following. And I, of course, don't know what their policy is, but to remove him from his deanship because of him taking on a controversial case, unless that's their policy. If you're going to do controversial cases, you can't be a dean here. Then that's uncalled for, because he also left the defense team, as I heard a few days ago, that he decided he's not going to be on the defense team.
And a quote here from Professor Sullivan, or the attorney, he says, "It is particularly important for this category of unpopular defendant to receive the same process as everyone else. Perhaps even more important," he says. I got to agree. Even just the accusation, just like I heard a clip earlier of Kavanaugh saying something, that whole process destroyed his reputation, put his family under all that stress. I don't want to litigate the facts of it, but the accusation puts a person under so much pressure that, by golly, man, you should be able to defend yourself with everything you can throw at them, because even like just the accusation just completely destroys everything around you.
Every American should be appalled that, since we have an adversarial system, that we would want a person not to have representation in an adversarial system. That would be like sending your military to battle without giving them any weapons.
Right.
Our system requires a jousting contest to take place. And the jousters are highly trained professionals. And to put a person in that ring without any representation is suicidal. And it should be objectionable to all Americans that we would expect a person to be in this arena with no representation. I'm appalled that people are so ill-informed that they would want Weinstein not to be represented. That's more appalling to me than anything.
Right.
I want Charles Manson to have representation, because he's in an arena where he can't control the environment, nor is he skilled or trained. And he probably did do something, not Weinstein, Manson probably did do what he got convicted of. But until it's proven beyond a reasonable doubt, he deserves his advocate. And he still deserves his advocate at sentencing, because there's a wide disparity in terms of what sentences can be imposed for criminality. And part of the attorney's job is to advocate for the best outcome for his or her client and put forth mitigation, write a sentencing memorandum, prepare the convicted person to testify and to speak at sentencing. That's all an attorney's job. You actually don't want that to happen?
I was online earlier today. I was looking at LegalZoom, which is, I'm sure you're familiar with it, but it's like cookie cutter contracts. But it brings it down to a very reasonable, affordable level for things that are incredibly common, wills or like a car sale kind of agreement. There's even some contracts in there for like dog walking, which I think is kind of funny. But my point here is that it's been commoditized to where you just give them your state, you give them a couple of details, and poof, they can spit out a contract. Great. But I do now appreciate much more that all of the nuances and all of the little intricacies and details of whatever trial, whatever case you're trying to defend yourself against, that the level of expertise, there's a big difference in someone that's very green and right out of college versus someone that's a seasoned warrior, I suppose you could say, in the jousting arena, as you just were saying. It is ridiculously expensive, and we don't have the facilities and the resources, particularly of someone like Harvey Weinstein, to mount anything of a reasonable defense.
Well, they would have thought about that before they did it.
There's always that, and we could make this show really short and just say,
What happens if they didn't do it?
I
don't buy that to start with. But what happens if they didn't do it?
Or like the strict liability thing where, like, hey, she said she was 18, and I mean, I believed her. What am I supposed to do? A background check on the person before we go and get busy?
Yes, boys, that's what you need to do.
I think that is something that we should actually like put in our public education system, and more so that, hey, look, you really ought not do this stuff without actually knowing, getting references and background checks on the people that you're hopping into bed with, which is really disturbing. There's also another article that we have from The Atlantic that talking about the dean being removed, and it's just talking about the damage that Harvard has done and the trust of having these people that they should be tenured. They should be sort of protected from what the public outcry would be, the horde of people. And anyway, so it's just a continuation of the Harvey Weinstein, but from a completely different angle. And that one comes out of The Atlantic.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. Want to support Registry Matters on a monthly basis? Head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
This one I think is kind of neat. I listened to the news clip, but it's Oklahoma House passes criminal justice reform measure to apply state question retroactively. This is pretty exciting, I think, as far as criminal justice reform things go, where they have moved a whole bunch of things. I think it's 700 items. They've moved them to be more like on a misdemeanor list. But then they said that they're going to do something where it's going to circle back around. And it would retroactively apply to people and affect 60,000 people that have been convicted of felonies.
That is such fantastic news.
It is amazing. And he had a really thick Oklahoma accent too. He said, you get out and you can't get a job because you have a felony. You can't get a lawyer because you don't have any money. You can't get a lawyer because you don't have any money. And you can't get a job because you can't get a lawyer. You're stuck in this cycle.
Oh, and I'm glad that they've recognized that. And the nice thing about this is, to the extent it can be bipartisan, which Oklahoma has very few Democrats left, but this is one of those things where those few Democrats are not going to criticize the Republicans saying that they're soft on crime. So this is a done deal, because it's kind of like the First Step Act, where the only real opposition was coming from the conservatives led by Tom Cotton in the U.S. Senate. This is one of those things where there's no political loss, because the one Democrat that's in the legislature in Oklahoma is not going to criticize this. And let me just see how many it is, because I know it's a heavily Republican state. But you're not going to get any political damage. And basically, they've decided they just can't afford to have such a high rate of incarceration in Oklahoma.
It finally
dawned on them. But it didn't dawn on them when they're making all those rules to make everything felonies.
That's what I was just going to say. I mean, like, they didn't think about it up front, so they let the system get overcrowded and expensive and all that. And they're like, oh, maybe we should adjust this. But it took a generation for it to actually, like, kick in and actually have the impact that for them to change their mind.
Well, now, in the House, let's just be fair, there's 39 Republicans and 9 Democrats. So the 9 Democrats are not meaningful. I mean, that's a supermajority.
Yeah, no doubt.
And then in the House of Representatives are 76 Republicans and 25 Democrats. There again, you've got a supermajority. You need a supermajority to be able to run the place without any really deference to the other side. When you've got more than 2/3, you don't need to care about what the other side thinks, because it's irrelevant.
Yeah, and they're probably just in Tulsa and Oklahoma City is probably where all those people are.
Yeah, but of those, they're not going to vilify the Republicans for doing this. They're pretty much for it. If you flip that over, you run the risk of being vilified if you can't get the Republicans to join you, because they're going to say, like they said about Obama, that they're turning loose a tidal wave of crime on America.
Right.
When he was trying to roll back some of the excesses of our system. And, but I don't expect there to be any vilification. I think it's great news to make this retroactive and help these people, and I commend them.
Absolutely.
For taking these steps. People say, we don't have any positive news. We just gave you some.
Is there anything, like Ted Cruz, I guess it is, or maybe, I think it's Ted Cruz, they've pushed really hard. Maybe it's Paul Ryan. They've pushed really hard to say that any bill that we're going to put forth, we're going to attach money to it to see, you know, if there's no funding for it up front, we're not going to even consider it. Is there not something on the other side in these criminal justice bills where, hey, we're going to go after, pick this crime? What is going to be the criminal justice impact going down? You know, do we have to start pre-funding to build prisons? Because that's got to take a decade or something to build a prison. Is there any sort of thought process when they make criminal laws that there's going to be an impact on the prison system?
Yes, there are fiscal impact reports. They keep in mind, more of our legislatures are part-time. They have very short sessions, 30, 60, 90, 120 days, relatively short period of time. And there are hundreds of bills moving. But the fiscal impact analysis oftentimes get fudged because it's indeterminable. They know. If you take something that's a fourth degree felony, for example, and make it a second degree felony, and you take the maximum exposure from 18 months to 9 years, we do know that on a 9-year sentence that you're going to spend more than you are on an 18 months. We can figure that out.
It doesn't take a lot of complicated math, does it?
But there's some things we don't know. What we don't know is how many more police officers are going to be dedicated to a special unit to enforce that crime because it carries a stiffer sentence. We don't know how much of the 9 years the judge is going to impose because that is available to them, because unless you mandate a mandatory portion of the 9 years, you don't know how much it's going to be probated. So it's very difficult. So what we can tell you in a fiscal impact report is that the average cost per prisoner is $42,000. I just pulled that out of my hat, but somewhere around $40,000 in my state. We can tell you that we'll have more prisoners in the system.
Right.
We can tell you that. But we don't know how many. And we don't know how quickly we'll see them materialize. We know that there's going to be, so they'll say, an indeterminate effect, difficult to analyze. But see, you just looked at the prison. You made the mistake. You didn't look, well, if you have a more serious crime, you're going to also have more people involved on the other side, on the prosecution side, because the office of the prosecutor is going to take the more serious crimes, and they determine seriousness by the amount of time it takes. So they're going to devote more staff power to that. The trying to keep the person defended is more complicated because they're facing, you're going to spend a whole lot more resources trying to defend, hopefully, someone facing 9 years in prison than somebody facing 90 days on a petty misdemeanor. So you've got a more complex system. The pre-sentence reports have to be more thorough. What happens when a person, after they work out a resolution, all the machinery along the way is impacted by making something a more serious crime. And quantifying that and figuring out how it's going to affect all the moving parts is very difficult to do. So it's easy to pass it because, you know, the impact is going to be, incremental and in the future, and it's difficult to identify. And by the time you identify it, when you've got 60,000 people in prison where you had 30,000 20 years ago, and the cost of your corrections department has gone up by 350%, the people who made those policies are long gone.
It doesn't sound like it would be complicated math. It probably scale. There's probably some sort of efficiencies in there to you know, two more people doesn't always mean double the cost. But there's also larger infrastructure things and transporting and all that other stuff. But if you make stuff where if you have double the number of people, like, shouldn't you end up spending twice as much? I mean, it can't be that hard to figure out.
It's a little more complicated than that, but yes, you do know that the costs are going to go up, and they do fiscal impact reports, which is what your question is. Most states that I've had anything to do with, they have some process to try to analyze the fiscal impact that's going to have on that particular state and all the agencies that are going to be, that have interplay, and they send out requests for comment from all the agencies that potentially have an impact, and the agency sometimes declines to comment, or they put in comments that we don't know how much it's going to impact us, but it will impact us. And if it's something where there's a lot of public, there's public support to do something, and the public doesn't care about the funding.
I was just going to ask it. I mean, so on the flip side, should you even put any sort of price tag on having a safe society?
Well, that's what some people say. Now, the funny thing is, they don't want to pay any taxes either. if they'll always tell you that taxes are too high. And of course, we're one of the lowest tax nations, but that's a discussion for another podcast. But they'll always tell you taxes are too high. But they'll tell you that some things are just, you don't even look at the money. You should just do it because it's the right thing to do. But when you double your correctional system, it's just like doubling your educational system. If all of a sudden you have a school system has goes from 40,000 to 80,000 in a 5-year period of time, you're going to have an exponential explosion in the cost of schooling your kids in that district. Well, that's one thing you really can't control as much, because growth and population trends, you just have to do your best you can to anticipate crunching those numbers and preparing for growth. But the corrections, that is something you can directly impact, because the policies that we make determine how many people we have in that system.
So did I just hear you hint that the FYP Studios is going to create an economics podcast? Is that what I heard you just say?
I don't think there'd be a problem with that.
Should we head on over to the Boston Herald article? Are you ready, or have you come off that soapbox?
I think so.
All right. Well, from the BostonHerald.com, this is SJC, which is their Supreme Judicial Court. They have a strange name for their highest court. Rules convicted sex offender Wayne Chapman can be set free. He still faces a court.
This is breaking news, isn't it?
Oh, I'm sorry. Hang on. Wait. Pause. I missed my cue. You know, we're going to get a cease and desist order from CBS at some point, right?
So now we have breaking news.
All right, breaking news. This is only a couple days old, so it's from the 16th. So
now it's time for the click, click, click.
Oh, God, man, I'm never going to. This is too much work, man. I can't do all this. All right. Well, this article comes from the Boston Herald. It's only a couple days old. And the Supreme Judicial Court ruled that this guy, Wayne Chapman, can be set free, but he still faces a court date on lewd behavior charge. I got Larry, if looks were anything, this guy is very creepy looking, and he got convicted like 100 years ago. He's admitted to sexually abusing some 100 boys in the United States and Canada, starting when he was 7. But he's been in prison for forever, but he is now going to be allowed to be released. But this is the article that you wanted to cover as the feature article of the night. So tell me what you have in mind for this one.
Well, I don't think we give enough attention to civil commitment as it pertains to sexual offenders. And it's not that we don't care. It's just that there's so much out there. And this is one of those instances where there was a favorable decision that could have some additional impact beyond Chapman. And the state was being a little bit duplicitous in his case. He's been in, like Andy says, forever and ever. Since the 70s, and he's petitioned for release a number of times, and it's been denied. But finally, in 2016 or 18, the examiner said that he could be released. And then the state didn't want him to be released, and they tried to interfere with his release. And this decision is a wonderful read for people who love legalities, because contrary to popular belief out there that civil commitment is somehow something that only happens in 20 states, it happens in, I think, all of our states. But this opinion helps you distinguish between the civil commitment that all states do to individuals who are mentally defective and dangerous versus what they do to a sexual offender. So I printed up a PDF and we'll make it available. And I made some highlights in it, which I've been doing recently.
Thank you.
But the issue presented on this appeal is whether the statutory scheme set forth in general law, C-123A, an individual who seeks to be discharged from civil commitment as a sexually dangerous person must remain civil committed while awaiting trial, sometimes for years, after both qualified examiners have concluded that he or she is no longer sexually dangerous. And they had ruled in a case called in Johnstone back in 2009, a decade ago, that is not correct, that they can't continue to hold them. Well, the Commonwealth decided that they wanted to continue to hold Chapman because he's high profile, he's yucky, and they wanted to continue to hold him. And the highest court in the state says, no, you cannot get around Johnstone. That's existing precedent, and we're not going to overrule ourselves on that because you haven't given us any reason to do so. But then if you go to page 4, they start talking, they compare the differences in sex offender civil commitment and regular civil commitment. So I want all the people who get so angry that we say civil commitment is constitutional to understand that the reason why we say that is because it is. All states and the federal government civilly commit people. The question is whether or not you provide proper due process for the civilly committed. With sex offenders, they don't provide a robust enough due process. If you look, as you read through this 15 pages, they talk about how in regular civil commitment, a person can only be held for like 24, 48 hours before several steps have to take place. Then they can be held at most for a month. And then they have to have regular, robust review processes to see if they're still dangerous. And then they compare it with the sex offender civil commitment, which is from one day to life, and how that they don't get the same robust reviews. And this is just a great read for those who like legal stuff. And ultimately, Chapman is going to be released, just like Hinckley was ultimately released. Despite all the U.S. government's protestations, he got released because the professionals viewed him no longer as dangerous. What he did in 1981 was no longer a threat to public safety today. And when we civil to commit a person, we're supposed to be working to restore them to they're no longer dangerous. That's what happened in this case. Chapman is no longer dangerous, according to the experts. You got to let him go, boys and girls. You have to let him go.
And he's also, I mean, he's been locked up for like over 40 years, and he's looking pretty old. I mean, he might be like 70 years old. I don't see what his age is in this article. But you know, somebody says that they never age out, the registrants. They never age out. They will never be cured of their illness. And I'm inclined to disagree with that. Like, you will eventually, like, you're not going to have the energy to go do things. You're not going to have the stamina to go do things. You're not, you know, think things start to peter out, as it were. And I'm speaking only from a male side. There are women that commit crimes too, but I imagine that they likely age out too.
So the importance of precedent and how difficult it is for them. They weren't interested in overruling Johnstone, and the state is going to have to accept the fact that once, if they can't convict him of the, and I think these are charges he picked up while in the hospital. I think he was supposed to have looked down a dress or fondled somebody or did something. And old people do that. That's one of the most common things that happen with people as they age, when they go into assisted care, as their mental faculties degrade. They start saying inappropriate things,
right,
and they start touching people, and they start acting weird. It's a part of the deterioration mentally. That doesn't make you a sexual predator. That makes you a deteriorating mentally individual, which happens to so many of us as we age. Unfortunately, it's uncomfortable for those who work in that environment, and they have to endure the rude comments and being touched inappropriately. But that doesn't mean that he's out there on the streets trying to be a sexual deviant and trying to do something. I mean, this was stuff he did apparently to very young, if I read this right, wasn't it boys?
Yeah, that's what it looks like. It says down there at the bottom. I do have a question in regards to this, though. We set up prison terms for people to, you know, to whatever, repent and reflect on what they've done. When do we stop keeping people locked up because we're angry at them? I mean, isn't that feels like the reason why they don't ever want to let this guy go is because we're still like, he creeps us out, and maybe he is creepy, but like, I don't think we should keep people locked up just because we're angry at them.
That's exactly what's happening here. This, what he did was so abhorrent that they can't let it go. Shooting the president is pretty abnormal. I mean, have we had a shot in our history?
Never.
And not only was the president, it was four additional individuals that were shot.
Right.
It was difficult to let go of Hinckley. but he was found not guilty by insanity. And once his dangerousness had been addressed, he was supposed to be let go.
And did he get released before Reagan died?
No, he did not.
Okay. That probably was a contributing factor.
I did not think he would, but the key players have deceased before he got released. That would be Reagan and Press Secretary Brady. Then there were some D.C. Police officers involved. I remember one named Della Henty. Don't remember the other one, but it was I think a total of five.
Well, there we go. Is there anything?
So Hank, and all the legal junkies read this about it next week, because I know that. I found it fascinating to read this about the process of civil commitment. And civil commitment is a viable tool that has long been accepted as being constitutional, but it's only for the time necessary to restore the person to they're no longer dangerous. That's all we're supposed to be doing. It's not punishing them. It's supposed to be helping them.
If there's nothing else, that's going to wrap it up, Larry.
that right? Well, then how do we get the podcast to grow?
How about we send out Jolly Ranchers to everybody on the registry and tell them to listen?
Sounds like one idea. How do we do that?
Well,
do you have phone numbers and names and addresses for everybody?
We certainly could get the addresses. I guess I can stop the ticker tape parade now, huh?
I think you can.
But obviously, the website is registrymatters.co, and you can find, I almost always forget to tell people, there is a transcript that gets done, and it's pretty accurate. It's done by some artificial intelligence, but you can pick up a transcript and other show notes, whatever. You can get all the links to the articles that we covered tonight at registrymatters.co. You can also listen to the podcast there if you want to. You can also sign up for an email notification when the show comes out from there as well. Larry, your favorite thing is you want people to call in and leave voicemail questions, and the phone number to do that is 747-227-4477. And how can people reach us by email, Larry?
Oh, that's easy.
Is it?
Registrymatterscast@gmail.com.
Outstanding. And of course, go ahead.
And I forgot to tell people that on the late breaking news, we need your help. Because I would like to make this a regular segment where something in the 24 to 36 hours preceding recording comes out, and we want to report late breaking stuff and the hundreds of people out there that are listening, just shoot something to us at you tell them how to get it to us. But if something is late breaking that you think would have interest, get it to us and we'll select that as the late breaking news segment.
Email is probably the best thing, or you can send in a voicemail and I'll certainly get those. And then how about the best way for people to support the podcast? What do they got to do, Larry?
Well, that's even easier. They just have to go to patreon.com/registrymatters and sign up. And they can do that at any amount beginning at $1 per month.
Outstanding. Even just a buck, huh?
Even just a buck.
Perfect.
Matter of fact, we've got some, and we're grateful to everybody. The buck is impressive because it's going to help us get to that 100 patrons by the end of the year.
Outstanding. Perfect. 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 Well, that's going to wrap it up. And I appreciate all the people in the chat and listening to the live stream. And without further ado, Larry, I will. I'll see you next week.
Bye.
Good night. Bye.
Thank you for joining us here at FYP. And we hope you will join us again on our next broadcast.